I'm Jay Miller, and today on George Fox Talks, I'm joined by Alicia Dietzman to talk about her most recent book, The Poetry of John Donne, and whether art is meant to be understood. Today in the studio, I'm joined by Alicia Dietzman. Alicia has an MFA in poetry from the University of Wisconsin and a PhD in divinity with a focus on aesthetics and ethics from University of St. Andrews. And today we'll be talking about her most recent book of poetry, her first book, Sweet Movie, which was a National Poetry Series winner. And it just came out last year, 2023.
Yeah, in October.
Great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking specifically about a passage of a sequence in the book that's dedicated and engaged with the poet, dedicated to engaging with the poetry of John Donne, specifically his Holy Sonnets. But before we get into that, I just want to talk more broadly about your approach as a poet and kind of where that comes from. So Sweet Movie is the title of a film I'm guessing a lot of people aren't familiar with, but this is a 1974 avant-garde film by, who's the filmmaker?
Dusan Makaviev.
Okay. So in some ways, this book is engaged with a film and uses a film as its overarching kind of conceit. And that happens in small ways as well, too. I'm interested, how does your work on aesthetics and film and art that you did with your PhD intersect with your work as a poet, where you're actually kind of engaging with film and visual art as well?
Sure. I mean, I pursued a PhD that focused on contemporary art because I really like contemporary art. So I think that there's mm-hmm. this thing where I both was already interested in contemporary art before I pursued it academically, was already interested in contemporary art when I started writing this. I started writing the book of poetry before my PhD and then continued working on it through my PhD. So there's interest there. Before my academic work kind of started to bleed a little bit into my poetic work, but it definitely influences, I think, particularly some of the choices I make in terms of the art that I interact with. Makaviev's work is somewhat controversial, Sweet Movie perhaps in particular. Some of his work is actually fairly mainstream, but Sweet Movie is a fairly complex and somewhat transgressive film. And my dissertation, I wrote about contemporary art that kind of has a tendency to unsettle audiences and mm-hmm. kind of the sort of responses that people have to art that they're not sure how to approach. And that's something that's just, I'm very excited about. I love art like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the, not all of the work, but a lot of the work in the book is maybe art that hasn't always been received super well by audiences mm-hmm. and, has unsettled them. Yeah, I think too, and I don't always get there in this book, but I think there is an interest in kind of pushing myself to write work that perhaps unsettles people a little bit. And again, I'd almost wish I had gone further because I don't think I was quite comfortable with that yet. But the more I kind of explored art like that, and I think the value of somewhat transgressive art, it made me think about it made me push myself more as an artist to think about how I could write poetry that perhaps had a somewhat unsettling effect on people.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that the interest in transgressive art? Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about John Donne mm-hmm. In a little bit, who in some ways we can read as transgressive, but mm-hmm. and also in some senses is like a hyper-canonical, English poet from the Renaissance. So I'm curious, is that interest in transgressive art longstanding for you? Or was that starting to develop kind of more around the time you did the MFA?
Mm. I think it's definitely longstanding. I think I've heard before that your dissertation is always an elaborate defense of your worst tendencies, mm-hmm. and I think that mine was a little bit of a defense of some of the art that I had been drawn to. I think particularly as a Christian, because I sometimes felt that my the places that I could see God were maybe a little bit unconventional. Mm. I think, too, the MFA maybe pushed me a little bit to think about transgressive art more, because even though I don't think all elements, as I said, of this book are unsettling or transgressive, some of the work that I would bring into the workshop was received poorly for ethical reasons. And that mm-hmm. made me think a little bit about what makes a work of art transgressive, like what makes it uncomfortable for people. And I wanted to explore that. So I think there's you know, an interest. I think that even since I was like a kid, honestly, I've always been definitely since I was a teenager drawn to things that are maybe a little bit controversial. I have a contrarian streak. And then entering into the MFA, I think I was surprised to find that not just in my interests, but that people were sometimes unsettled by my own work. And I wanted maybe to defend myself actually a little bit.
Yeah. One of the ways you go about engaging with the art that interests you is kind of in the form of a literary technique known as ekphrasis. Mm-hmm. That's just a fancy term for verbal representation, kind of most technically, I think, of a work of art. So just anytime, like if you saw a painting at a museum and then you were describing it to a friend later, that would kind of be ekphrasis in action. And in a way, the fact that you're looking to a film as the kind of governing image, if you will, of your collection and engaging with both visual but also written art in your kind of individual poems, that makes this an ekphrastic project. Could you talk a little bit about why ekphrasis is a compelling approach to these poems for you?
Yeah, I love that question just because I am really excited about ekphrasis, obviously, I guess, if you read the book. I think that like the first answer, and I've had to think about this a lot, and I didn't have this answer when I started writing the book. Like, I couldn't have told you why I liked ekphrasis so much. And it kind of annoyed people at certain points who were like helping me along the way, like during my my MFA, they'd be like, no more ekphrasis, we're done. You can't write about art anymore. As I said earlier, I just like art a lot. Mm-hmm. But I think it also, as I've started to think about why I'm so drawn towards ekphrasis, I think that I have a hard time directly kind of getting at the self or just talking about the self. And there's really a lot of reasons for that. I think some of it's just like, you know, it's like, I'm middle child of like a large-ish family and like I kind of, you know, comfortable fading into the background. Mm. I think sort of just learning to talk directly. I mean, actually, I've probably never learned to talk directly about the self. So I think ekphrasis was a way that I could, kind of start to think about my inner world and like interiority without just being like, here's a poem about me, you know. And often, you know, again, like they are poems about my inner world in the sense that I'm taking a work of art and kind of using that as a vehicle to sort of drive back towards myself slowly sometimes because it's even now it's still anxiety inducing for me. It's been a very, very useful tool for me. So someone's just like, I love art. I love looking. I love observation. This is like a kind of a collection that I think it's almost like fan poems because there's just so many like things I like in it and I want other people to like. But also I think it was a kind of a sneaky way to start to write about myself a little bit.
So you talked about these poems to some extent as fan poems. And in a way, in terms of, there's a lot of different art and artists you engage with in here. But I think just quantitatively, the artist you engage with most is John Donne. And I think that makes a lot of sense in some ways based on what we've talked about, because he in some ways is a transgressive poet. He also is very inward. He's exploring his kind of inward landscape. And I don't know if he does ekphrasis technically or ekphrasis, but he's very image-driven in his own writing. He's kind of part of a set of poets known as the metaphysical poets, who are known for elaborate kind of verbal pictures or conceits. I'll just say a little bit about Donne for listeners who don't know. He's a late 16th, early 17th century poet, a Renaissance poet. He writes kind of more what we might call secular poetry kind of early on in his life. He grows up as a recusant Catholic, so kind of like the underground Catholic community in England at the time. Maybe, you know, that gives him a transgressive sense for being like an underground Catholic. He becomes an Anglican priest around the time of James I and eventually becomes the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral and writes a lot of religious work and religious poetry, as well as sermons. So he's a very interesting and prominent poet. In some ways, it makes sense to me that you would engage with him, but in other ways, he's an outlier in this text. A lot of your interest is in contemporary art. Mm-hmm. So could you say a little bit about why, given your interest in contemporary art, you end up having 16 poems about John Donne's Holy Sonnets?
That's a great question. I think, again, like, some of it's just really straightforward. I just like Dunn's work. In terms of like interacting with other texts, sometimes it's just sort of like if a text strikes me or it's been, you know, deeply meaningful for me, I just end up in some way engaging with it. And it'll keep reappearing. This is not the only interaction I've had like in my poetry with Dunn. This is just what made it to the book. I've written mm-hmm. other poems that interacted with his work. And there's one more actually in this book that mentions Holy Sonnets. Mm. He's just has been a kind of a part of my kind of like poetic imagination. Mm-hmm. As to why I was like drawn to him, you were saying he's a very like image-driven poet, which I would say my work is very, very focused on the image. I think it's part of just like a resonance. Like, I just like his work. I think mm-hmm. it has, it's very, this is a term we use more for fiction, but like, it's like voicey. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like I could hear his voice. I like that he has a really strong and distinctive syntax. So strong. In fact, I feel that even when I interact with his work, because I actually draw directly from his work and use some of the language that, he has in Holy Sonnets. It's like you can't, even as I rearrange his language, you can't really quite like break his syntax totally. It's very, very strong and it's very apparent. Mm-hmm. So I really admire that. I think too, I don't always love like devotional work. I haven't always resonated with the kind of like sort of canonical like Christian works of art, which I feel like Holy Sonnets is very much so a part of that. But like this, you know, his work in Holy Sonnets is something that just like really resonated with me the first time I read it. And I don't actually remember when that was, but it's mm-hmm. it's definitely something that spoke to me spiritually. And I felt like I just connected with, like the forcefulness of it and the way that it's like, it has a kind of earthiness to it. And it felt, I don't know. I think it just was one of the few kind of sort of like, like devotional works that I've read that just really felt I could see my own spiritual, like, I hate the word spiritual journey, but I could see my own spiritual journey in it. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really resonate with that also, you know, as a Christian intellectual, and thinking for me, having this training in literature and literary studies, oftentimes when you're in that kind of theology and literature or religion and literature conversation, you have a set of texts that are your go-to sort of text. So Dunn, and especially Dunn's Holy Sonnets, maybe not his earlier work that's edgier, but in continuity, you're reading Holy Sonnets. Maybe you're reading Dante's Divine Comedy. You're reading T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. Maybe you're reading something like Annie Dillard, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, et cetera. All wonderful texts, but I do think one kind of can develop a sense. I sometimes find myself longing for more. Like, can we read a little bit more widely as Christians and engage? What I appreciate about what you're doing, Alicia, is that I think it can become tempting for Christian academics to just kind of become a little tired of that standard canon and then just kind of leave it behind. So what I really appreciate is that, like, you have all the interests in the really avant-garde out there stuff, but you're going back to Dunn and like recuperating that as a still an important text to engage with, but engaging with it kind of on your own terms as someone who's interested in the transgressive or maybe the less kind of straightforwardly mm-hmm. devotional mm-hmm. approach in a way that's really interesting. I think it'd be interesting to read some of the poems now and talk about kind of what stands out to you about them, or like show readers or listeners how you're engaging with Dunn a little bit. Again, you have 60, could you talk just more before we do that? Can you talk generally about like how you approach these kind of 16 poems in the book and where Dunn you think fits in the larger sequence of the book to the extent mm-hmm. that it is a sequence?
Sure. I was gonna say, so this is like, it's like, I like to think of this and I do this a lot, but I like to think of this as both something that is a single poem called Holy Sonnets and also mm-hmm. as a sequence, mm-hmm. and it could be read either way. Even like to think of it a little bit as something you could sort of like take like an almost like playing card or something and like, you know, rearrange the sections and you would mm-hmm. still have something that was, you know, cohesive and interesting. In terms of like how I, you're just maybe how I came, like the structure and the.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, just looking at this, so Dunn kind of falls, you have this in four parts. So Dunn mm-hmm. comes in the fourth part.
Yes.
I guess I just wonder, was there any kind of thought about like where in your collection you placed Dunn?
Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of, I had to think a lot about order. I'm not a super linear thinker, and that was a really long process for me after I had written the poems. It's just like, and a lot of it's like, was like literally printing out the poems. Poets do this a lot. They love to just like print out the poems and just kind of rearrange mm-hmm, them physically mm-hmm. and
stand on a chair with them all on the floor.
And I thought a lot about this, and I had several versions of this, but this was the first poem. Because I think this sequence or poem is super significant for me, and I think it is the most personal. I was talking earlier about my struggles to kind of like get at the self, and I think this is the most intimate poem for sure. I think the voice is a tonal shift actually that occurs with this poem, and that's part of the reason why I wanted it to come later, because I wanted people to maybe not have that intimacy right away, particularly because you don't want to give people intimacy and then withdraw. You know, I think it's a lot better to sort of build towards that. I do think just in terms of voice, this is a this feels very personal to me. And I had a couple of early readers who mentioned that they're like, well, you can't start with that, cause that's the most intimate work. You know, you gotta work towards that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some real wrestling with maybe some of the spiritual questions that I start to kind of, you know, they're not overt. I think it's like a lot of poetry, and my poetry is perhaps more so than a lot of poetry tends to be a little opaque, but I think I often we say the speaker when we're talking about who's talking in poetry, but I am the speaker. I think I am wrestling a lot spiritually and in the early parts of the book. And this is maybe one of the, I wouldn't say there's a conclusion here, but we're kind of moving towards that mm-hmm. in the final section for me.
And again, I think Dunn makes sense as an artist for you to be in conversation with, kind of both for the spiritual wrestling mm-hmm. and also maybe the opacity of his own poetry. Because oftentimes we'll read some Dunn a little in just a minute in this conversation, but this kind of school of poetry, he's known as these metaphysical poets. They're known for these kind of elaborate, sometimes difficult mm-hmm. kind of setups of this poetry. You know, you kind of have to sit with these images, and they can navigate multiple spaces, and they're oftentimes making connections between mm-hmm. things you wouldn't otherwise connect with. Well, I wonder if we might dive in. So this one poem, Holy Sonnets, comes in something like 16 parts. And each, is that a fair way of saying it?
Yeah.
There are kind of 16 little poems in this larger poem, if you will.
That's perfect.
And each poem starts with a line from mm-hmm. Dunn. We'll unpack that more later, but you start with a line from one of Dunn's Holy Sonnets and then write your own poem following mm-hmm. that. So I think what we decided to do is you're going to read from a section of those 16 poems, sections 3 through 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll talk about how one of those poems engages with Dunn. And then we'll talk about the poem itself a little bit.
Sure. Perfect. Okay. So I'll be starting at 3. O holy discontent, some fruit night scouting. Lord, you did not leave me. If nothing else remains, let this. 4. Like doom grace. I said I know enough to get by. I know where the gun is kept and how to use it. This surprises people sometimes. I know where the money is too and the keys. I know what we can't outrun, and I know when to give up and reveal the morning tongues of my arms and like it. Some, I listen. 5. I'm a little new land, burn me. I tell you what, I'd like to let you cut me in the courtyard where I'm weakest and sweetest, and one day I will understand myself in a grand historical sense, I know.
Thank you. So I want to start with number 4. We can talk about all these, but the poem number 4 here, the line you take from Dunn is like doom grace. And I want to read now the holy sonnet that inspires this poem that you get the language from, so we can kind of see how you're in conversation with Dunn a little bit. So the holy sonnets are sometimes numbered differently. So if people dig into the holy sonnets at home, you might find something else. But so this is holy sonnet number 4. We don't actually know what order Dunn intended at this time. In fact, you know, Dunn didn't publish most of his poetry. It was kind of in manuscript form. It was completely like a coterie poetry environment at this time. So we do our best guess with numbering. So here's Dunn's Holy Sonnet number 4. O my black soul, Now thou art summoned by sickness, death's herald and champion. Thou art like a pilgrim which abroad hath done treason and durst not turn to whence he's fled. Or like a thief which till death's doom be read, wishes himself delivered from prison, but damned and haled to execution, wishes that still he might be imprisoned. Yet grace, if thou repent, thou canst not lack, but who shall give thee that grace to begin? O make thyself with holy mourning black, and red with blushing, as thou art with sin. Or wash thee in Christ's blood, which hath this might, that being red, it dyes the red souls to white. Alicia, I wonder if you could just say a little bit about how that sonnet on the whole hits you, and then how you got from this whole sonnet to the three words you take from it, like doom, grace.
Yeah, I mean, I think this sonnet, and I mean, the Holy Sonnets in general, I, as I said, I think they're resonant for me, in part because I feel like there's this spiritual wrestling that I just related to. I think there is almost like a fear of grace. It's like doom grace, this thing. I think that that's, I think in many ways these are like erasures, like the lines I have at the top that kind of allow the reader to see what sonnet I am responding to are essentially erasures, and we're kind of distilling down.
Could you say more about that erasure technique in contemporary poetry?
Yeah, it's a fairly common technique in contemporary poetry, I use it semi-frequently as an exercise to kind of think about language in new ways. But basically, erasure is where you take someone else's text and you then remove language and like alter language. Often you would have to follow. It's pretty common for it to follow a particular form, which I do not do. Where I'm trying to think of how to best like explain this without like a obvious like visual representation of this.
This is an ekphrastic moment, actually,
yeah. which I'm going to struggle with, which is great. But typically, it would follow the order of the text. So like, because sometimes people are like literally erasing, erasure could be something where you have like a page from a book and you're like taking white out, or you're taking a black pen and you're just marking out words. And in that case, whatever you come up with has to follow the same order as, you know, like the paragraph or the sentences occur. But I am just sort of mixing things around. Like there's not always a like, you know, I in this particular instance, I think that like doom does come before grace, but that's not always the case at all. But I'm doing some kind of wild erasure where I'm just kind of pulling things from. The only rule I think I would say was that it had to appear in that sonnet, and then I could otherwise rearrange it however I wanted. But yeah, I wanted to use as a kind of a little sign that this was the particular sonnet I was responding to. And I do kind of see it as a, you know, as a, and often erasure is this distilling down to kind of the essential elements of what that text is saying. Sometimes though, you know, erasure can be, and this is quite fun, it can be something totally different. You can take a text and you try to do something wildly different, you know, and you kind of almost
undermine it too. Yeah. Sometimes I've seen this in like, there can be kind of a political approach to it, where you're taking like a super canonical, may hegemonic or dominant kind of text and like undermining that sort of hegemonic aspect of it.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, I think that is probably the more typical way that erasure is used in contemporary poetics. So I think this is, I'm recognizing it's like, oh, that's actually somewhat unusual that I'm using it more as a distilling down to what I feel is the essential part of each sonnet.
But I think it's a helpful approach because, like we said, Donne can be a very complex poet. And this poetics of like the late 16th, early 17th century is like a worlds away from the poetics of today, which I think are much more about clarity and accessibility, especially like the more popular, you know, kind of contemporary poet is, the more it's about like kind of just a transparent, like this is a thought that you can, you know, I'm thinking about like a Billy Collins poem or a Mary Oliver poem, right? Those are great poems, but like the aesthetic is like accessibility in a certain way and transparency.
I think it's communication. I will say for me personally, I often think about this. Like I don't think of the primary goal of my work as like communicating necessarily.
Yes.
If that's, I mean, that's a strange thing to say, but.
Yeah. Or not communicating in an easy way.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, again, I think there's, I don't know if you'd identify with a sort of modernist aesthetic, but I think mm-hmm. that is a kind of difficulty is a kind of modernist commitment, and that, you know, modernists love John Donne for that reason. But you, in a way, make Donne more, you communicate what Donne communicates, because here what you do, so like doom, grace is kind of, are the words you pluck out of the poem. But you're really in some ways just collapsing, you know, a few lines here into one. So the like doom part, he's describing his soul as black, you know, he's wrestling with his own sin, whatever. And he says to his soul, thou art like a pilgrim, which abroad hath done treason and durst not turn to whence he's fled. So you're like a pilgrim who's done treason, who's hiding somewhere, or like a thief, which till death's doom be read, wishes himself delivered from prison. So a condemned thief. So you take the like from the pilgrim line, the simile, and you take doom from the thief example. But you're essentially saying what Donne's saying. You're saying like doom, and then you say he has a yet grace later, and you pull in the grace. So mm-hmm. I do think in some ways, I don't know if this is your goal, but I do think this is a very faithful distillation mm-hmm. of kind of Donne that shows his paradox, right? Because mm-hmm. you put doom and grace alongside of each other. Could you say a little bit about how doom and grace interplay in the rest of the poem for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think... It's a strange thing to say, but I do think there's ways, again, in my own sort of like spiritual practice in life, that sometimes there's elements of like grace that have felt like overwhelming and terrifying, and also something that I can't outrun, you know, which I talk about, and there's this sense of kind of almost like giving up. I think there's also this sense of awareness that I talk about, the kind of like awareness of like the inevitability of grace, like I could say how irresistible it is, but also that it's something that is, you know, a real something I'm terrified of. I think there's a lot of anxiety, I think, in this entire book and in this sequence. I think there's a sense of like movement and running. There's like a, you know, there's a pursuer always. And I think the pursuer is different at different points, but I think there's mm-hmm. some real anxiety in this particular. Anxious book all around, and I think, and I'm an anxious person actually, and I think the anxiety often kind of bleeds into my writing, but I can see it particularly in this particular poem.
Sure, that line, I know where the gun is kept and how to use it, you know, is I think a statement of anxiousness, mm-hmm. along with I know where the money is too, mm-hmm. and the keys. So like a gun, money, keys, like these kind of things of security. You know, you use the phrase irresistible grace, and you're also talking about anxiety, which for me are like kind of turning on the Calvinism buzzer. is it fair to say there's kind of a Calvinist theological backdrop to these poems mm-hmm. that's informing at least what you're wrestling with, or am I just kind of reading into that too much?
I think there is a little bit. I think I have. I'm trying to remember if it made it in. I feel like I should know exactly every single line in here.
I should say for listeners, like irresistible grace is kind of, if you think of the classic kind of acronym for Calvinism being kind of tulip. I won't break down the whole thing, but the I in there is irresistible grace. The idea that like if God sort of decides to save you, there's kind of nothing you can do to undermine that.
I technically am Presbyterian, and that's kind of the background that I'm coming from. My parents were pretty bad Calvinists. they're PCA and they're missionaries. But I do think that is something that lurks in the background for sure for me. Mm-hmm. And I was so sure that I had a anyway, at some point in some draft of this, whether it's here or not, and it's not, I don't think, in Love Poem by the Light of Something Obvious, which is towards the end of the book, I had something about like being like a one-point Calvinist, which I think was just about total depravity, which is always, mm-hmm. that's like my joke, that's the one I've hung on to.
I remember that line. The last line, your one point is always depravity.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Which was a good, it's actually not the last line of the poem.
No.
But it could be though. That's one of those poems like, maybe you could have cut the last three stanzas there, Alicia, and finish with that.
Yeah, thank you for the edits there. Actually, I don't hate that edit either. And I cut this poem down quite a bit and I'm like, could I have cut it down more? That's fine. I love that though. I would love my work to be, again, as such that it can be often like kind of like rearranged and it still works. Right. I like that. Yeah. I like to think of, I've heard somebody told me this and I don't remember who, but that every single line in a poem should be able to like stand on its own. And like that has really stuck with me.
And you're in some ways applying that aesthetic back to like Dunn's writing in a much more formalist kind of poetic time. So like there's meter, there's rhyme, it's a sonnet, like it's highly formal. But you're also showing the way, like, you know, we can also approach Dunn in this way of like we're pulling out like a line. So in some ways, I see your poems maybe as translations of Dunn as well.
I like that a lot.
You know, kind of, or like the, you know, maybe the a paraphrase of Dunn is maybe another way you're approaching it. I want to go back and maybe finish kind of with that idea of difficulty. Whether it's the idea of Dunn's difficulty and the reason he needs to be translated, but also your commitment to both maybe formal difficulty or thematic difficulty of your poems. You, like you said, the goal is not to communicate.
I feel bad saying that.
Well, I think that's fine. Like that is a commitment. There's value to that. There's value to making a reader work. So, but I guess and you also are committed not just to like your own text being difficult, but engaging with other difficult texts. Dunn, or whether that's something that's difficult in a completely different way, like avant-garde film, like Sweet Movie, or other aspects, or maybe even like, we're not really digging into like the subject matter, but like difficult subject matter, you know, kind of that you're kind of wrestling with. How do you imagine readers engaging with that difficulty? Do you imagine readers kind of, when they read a poem that's dedicated to like, or that's like explicitly kind of working in conversation with a contemporary piece of art, are you expecting them to look up that contemporary piece of art? Do you think they can just read the poem without seeing the art? How do you think about the expectations you have, or maybe expectations is a strong word, or the hopes you have for readers engaging with this material, whether it's Dunn or whether it's something else?
I like hopes. I like that. Yeah, because I try not to bring too many expectations.
Yeah.
I am totally fine if you know, people don't you know, look up the art, or I think a really good ekphrastic work, I think good at succeeding, I think you don't actually need to see or know the work of art to enjoy the poem. But at the same time, there's also this, like, you know, I said it earlier, it's a kind of like a fan book. I think I love the art that I interact with. Almost all of it's extremely meaningful for me. And I think particularly, this doesn't come up directly in the book, but, a lot of the artists are, Central and Eastern European. And I, that's where I spent a lot of my life. And I know that, people are sometimes less familiar with these artists, so it's exciting to me to think of maybe getting people invested and engaged with work that maybe they haven't experienced before. So it would be cool, you know, I guess, if people, like, it's not necessary, but I love to think that maybe this prompts someone to, like, you know, I don't know, go watch a Dusan Makabiev film. You know, I think that would be exciting for me. And if you do, Love Affair, The Case of the Missing Switchboard Operator is a great place to start. It's really great. Probably my favorite movie, actually. But not as great of a title as Sweet Movie.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great to end with a recommendation. Thank you so much for talking with us about Dunn and for bringing this larger set of voices into our set of awareness. So thanks for coming on the show today, Alicia.
Thank you so much.
This video podcast is a production of George Fox Digital. To find more material like this, you can subscribe to George Fox Talks on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Our team really appreciates your feedback in the form of likes, comments, and reviews, and we'd really love to hear what you think. To sign up for our weekly email list and to keep up to date with the latest episodes and publications, you can check us out on the web at georgefox.edu/talks. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.